We've also got to create these conditions to help our multilingual learners understand how they can apply it and help them develop the capacity to learn and also to want to learn. You know, even though it's relevant to them, we want to help people develop relationships both with teachers and with students so that, I mean, it's all interconnected.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis, and you just heard the voice of the one and only Larry Ferlasso, a veteran educator and one of the most prolific contributors to the multilingual education community. Larry has been teaching English and social studies to English learners and English proficient students at Luther Burbank High School in Sacramento for 21 years. He is also the author or editor of 13 books on education. He writes an advice column for Education Week and hosts an accompanying podcast, and he also hosts a popular resource sharing blog. His contributions are immense, varied, and quite powerful and useful. I suggest checking them out. In his second appearance on Highest Aspirations, we get into the topic of student motivation and what we can do to spark it, and maybe more importantly, what we can do to sustain it. Here are some of the questions we'll dive into in this episode. How can we apply the four aspects of self-determination theory to increasing opportunities for intrinsic motivation to flourish? What can teachers do in their classrooms to make their students, particularly multilingual learners, feel more connected to their learning? Why is it so important to find a healthy balance between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation for students? Larry and I get into all of that and much more. If you enjoy the Highest Aspirations podcast, please check out our EL community at elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity. You will find a huge, growing library of free, searchable multimedia content, including blog posts with key takeaways from Highest Aspirations episodes like this one. That database is completely searchable, so if you go to it and you just type whatever you're looking for in the top, you'll find probably a lot of different resources on that specific topic. As always, thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations, and please enjoy our conversation with the one and only Larry Ferlasso. Larry Ferlasso, welcome back to Highest Aspirations. It has been a long time. It's great to see you on Zoom, as it were, excited to talk about motivation and the new book that you have out called The Student Motivation Handbook, 50 Ways to Boost an Intrinsic Desire to Learn. How have you been?
Good. It's great to be back. A long time consistent listener to your podcast. So it's always an honor to be a guest.
Well, I appreciate it. I always love having people come back so people can revisit that last episode if they want to. I don't even really know how to summarize that. When I was just looking at it, we talked about everything.
Right.
I think it was a very sort of generalist friendly podcast episode, but today we're going to hone it in a little bit on a giant topic in and of itself, and one that I'm really excited that you've written about, and that's this idea of motivation, and specifically student motivation and intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation. And as I always try to do, I'll try to sort of tailor this, and we'll try to tailor this to multilingual learners, which is the students that most of our audience serve. But I think this one's going to be broader to encompass all students, and I think that's totally fine. So
great. Yeah, and it's certainly, as a teacher of multilingual learners and as a teacher of students who are proficient in English, I certainly apply these ideas to both groups.
Great. All right, so we're on the same page, because that was something I was thinking about is before we started. I was like, this is going to be wide. And I was actually talking to Teddy Rice, who's one of our co-founders. We had lunch today. I'm in the Boston office. And he said, you know, it'd be good to talk about all students in this one. I said, absolutely right. This one makes sense to kind of widen our scope a little bit. So I thought a good place to start maybe would be to kind of nerd out a little bit on some of these theories. You quote and reference a lot of experts on motivation that I had studied and looked at, probably not to the extent that you have, when I was at the Harvard Graduate School of Education about 8 years ago. And one of the things you talk about is self-determination theory, and that helps kind of create a foundation for us for motivation. Could you give us just like a quick primer on the theory, and then maybe spend most of the time talking about how it relates to this idea of intrinsic student motivation?
Sure. Well, in self-determination theory, it has three primary aspects. One is autonomy, with that students and all of us tend to be more intrinsically motivated to learn to do things if we have a role in deciding how to do it, how it's done. A second element is relatedness, is if what we are asking people to do or being asked to do, if it will bring them or us into relationship with people we like or respect.
Mm-hmm.
And competence, do we feel like that we are able, that we have the skills and the support necessary to do what we are being asked to do, right? Because nobody likes to fail. Relevance, it depends. You know, some people who have written about self-determination theory put relevance as a separate fourth element, as I do. Others include it in one of those other three. But it's certainly viewed as an important part by everybody who writes about self-determination theory, that is what people are being asked to do. Do they see it as relevant to their long-term goals and hopes? And or do they view it as fun or interesting to them? Right? So just as like, I'm not that interested in door-to-door salesmen, but I read a New Yorker article about door-to-door sales, and I was interested in that, right? So even though it didn't necessarily help me in my long-term goals, but it still is considered relevant because it was interesting. So those are generally the four elements that encompass self-determination theory. And in terms of how that applies to students, right? I mean, schools and teachers were so geared towards extrinsic motivation through grades, carrots, sticks, office referrals, consequences,
which
points.
We'll get into all those,
yeah,
for sure.
Where, you know, we're trying to push students to do what we want, or, and also in terms of our children, right? You know, many of us have also used those same strategies to get our children to do things. And what I like, I think what we need to think about is how we can create the conditions in which intrinsic motivation can flourish, right? We can't make things happen sometimes. You know, we can't make people have intrinsic motivation, but we can create the conditions in which students or our children are more likely to have it.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about creating conditions, so we have this idea of autonomy. I can see that giving students, you know, as somebody who's been a teacher for a long time and just a human, right? And talking to anybody and trying to motivate them, giving them some autonomy, relatedness, connection with other people, competence, giving them the skills or tools or expertise, or perhaps highlighting a skill that they may already have to let them accomplish that. And then there's the relevance one, this idea of personal relevance is the one that I want to expand on a little bit, because it's one that I've been hearing a lot about. It's always been important, but I feel like lately it seems to be even more important. I don't know if this is a COVID thing. And by the way, I'm glad that it's being highlighted as important. Expand on that personal relevance piece, if you will, and why it might be particularly important for multilingual learners and developing their sense of intrinsic motivation.
Right. I'm going to do that. Before I do that, I also want to highlight autonomy, which is, I think, another important element especially for multilingual learners, especially for immigrant students who have come to the United States, generally have had little role in the decision to come here, and many are not thrilled about having to leave their homes. So I think autonomy for multilingual learners is particularly important because of that position that their young people are in.
That's a great point.
And relevance, I actually think for ELL teachers, we have an advantage over, I think, most other teachers for every other subject.
Mm-hmm.
Because for so many of our students, the idea of learning English is relevant to everything they want to do,
yeah.
Right? Whether it is ordering food at a restaurant or ultimately getting a job or understanding what's going on in the movies, that it's like a gift that is offered to ELL teachers of relevance. I mean, we've also got to create these conditions to help our multilingual learners understand how they can apply it and help them develop the capacity to learn and also to want to learn, because it's hard, right? I mean, it's, you know, our students are torn away from their homelands, many of them. And, you know, even though it's relevant to them, the importance of relatedness, you know, they want to develop, we want to help people develop relationships both with the teachers and with students.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to feel successful, because learning English is so, so difficult, and so much more difficult than so many of their other languages. So that, I mean, it's all interconnected. But and I think the other important thing is, in relevance, making it fun, making it interesting, you know, playing games. That the idea of learning English and how it's relevant to their future hopes and dreams is like a given, I think, to many of our students, right? I mean, it's where many other teachers have to work hard, really hard, to help students see that. For us, that's the, you know, in many ways is the easiest part. But that doesn't mean students will automatically be energized to learn if it isn't fun, if it isn't done in an interesting way, if they don't have autonomy in it, if they can't work with people they like, or if they don't have a positive relationship with a teacher, or if they don't have the support to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like this isn't really pushing back, but I would dive in a little deeper, and I would contend that, or surmise maybe is a better word, that probably a little bit more of a push and a little bit more relevance and relatedness and competence and autonomy are necessary for academic language knowledge rather than the social knowledge, the social language knowledge that allows them to do a lot of things that you mentioned, understand a movie, have conversations with their friends, ask someone to go out on a date. I'm thinking of the high school level here just because that's my experience. And so probably adding all of those other elements of self-determination theory are even more important, even more interconnected when you're thinking about the academic language that may not be kind of right in front of your face, but a more long-term plan. What are your thoughts?
Oh, yeah. Very important point. And, you know, that also goes along with us having to help our students see the possibilities that they might have for the future. Right. And interestingly, at least in my classes, sometimes most of my students, ELL students, multilingual students, tend to have pretty high aspirations for themselves. And in many, and oftentimes higher professional aspirations than some of my English proficient students, right? I mean, it's, I would say that like 90% of the students in my classes, in my ELL classes, typically say, oh, they want to be doctors, they want to be police officers, they want to, you know, they want to be nurses. You know, they want to have those kind of professional goals, which is great to be able to then push them on the academic language,
right,
on the academic skills, right? It's when students say, well, you know, I want to be, you know, I don't know what I want to be, or I want to be a landscaper, which is fine, which is important. And which many of our families do, it just, it's a little more challenging to help them see the importance of gaining academic language when they say that that is their goal.
You know, and I think either way, whatever direction a student wants to take, the first step, and I'm just like, I've written all these down on post-it notes, just so I have it in front of me, these, the four elements of self-determination theory. And in order to do that, that all of that as a teacher, you need to have that relatedness component. You need to understand, you need to have the autonomy component. You need to understand who your students are and what their dreams and aspirations are in order to latch on or in order to use those levers, right? To pull those levers to get that motivation going. So it's such a cyclical thing, and it all comes down to knowing who our students are at the beginning and what they want.
Yeah. And, you know, good teachers, they, you know, tons of good teachers have never heard of self-determination theory, but they know, but they apply it, right?
Exactly.
I mean, it's good teaching. I think it's helpful to, you know, it's a helpful lens to analyze our teaching through.
Yeah. We speak the same language, you know, we have ideas, we understand what they are. I mean, there's always, I was one of those teachers. I started totally by accident. It wasn't until, you know, later, a couple master's degrees later in some class, I'd learn about something like this. And I'd say, oh, I was doing this stuff. I just didn't know what it was called. Or I said, I wasn't doing this stuff. And now I know the element that I was missing. That's the gap between research and practice that I always talk about that we really need. And I think, by the way, you do such a great job in doing that in your work because you have both lenses. I think that's a great thing. All right. So as I knew we would, we went down a bit of a rabbit hole there, which is fine. I think it's a useful one. I want to come back to the book. I didn't, like, you know, full transparency, I didn't read the entire book. I read some of the excerpts that you have on EdWeek and Edutopia, which are great, and we can link to those. But one of the quotes that I read in one of those experts, I'm going to read it to you because I think it's really important, then I'll have you reflect on it. And it's kind of like a nice little summary of what's happening in the world. And you said, if studies are concluding that it's important for students to feel that school content is relevant to their lives, if many students might be saying that they don't feel like it is, and if teachers are agreeing that students don't appear to see what is happening in school as relevant, then perhaps it would be worth us reflecting on what we've been doing in the classroom and consider making some changes. And then you go on in the article to kind of talk about a few things that people can do to actually make those changes. Let's do that here. I know there's a lot that we can talk about. I mean, the book has 50 strategies, but what, you know, on the whole, what changes should we be making? And maybe what are a couple strategies that teachers can be doing sort of right now and pretty quickly to help students make you feel more connected to what's happening in their academic lives?
Right. And first, I should point out that this idea of students saying that they don't feel like it's relevant is based on Gallup polls, Gallup surveys, scientifically done. And the idea that teachers agree with that assessment is also based on teacher surveys. So it's not just based on intuition or feeling. Right?
Although that intuition is there too.
right. But that is what students are saying, and that is what teachers are saying. And I think, you know, I think there are a number of things that we can do, and it also dovetails with this new emphasis on accelerated learning. I don't want to get into a rabbit hole, but you know, it's, you know, all these vendors are coming up with all these new ideas about how to do accelerated learning, whereas that's what ELL teachers, especially secondary teachers, have been doing for decades.
Yep.
Right? I mean, because students come to us late and
clock is ticking.
Right. And they've got to learn language and content. Right. And especially high schools who are required to provide a path of by law, a path to graduation for newcomers. We've got to do it. Right. So it just sort of boggles my mind on how so many districts don't understand that and don't look to ELL teachers as a source of professional development for all their teachers in the context of accelerated learning with the pandemic.
Earmark that one. That's a conversation for another time. Maybe next year we'll get together and talk about that.
Right, right. Well, and I think there are a variety of strategies and simple ones, right? For relevance, some simple ones include this idea of self-generating relevance, just asking students how they think they can apply what they've learned, right? And that's, lots of studies have found that that's very effective in increasing student intrinsic motivation. If you just give students time to think about it, they can figure this out. In terms of relevance, games, right? I mean, games are fun and you can learn a lot, and they're great formative assessment tools, whether they are classroom games with mini whiteboards where everybody has to answer, or, you know, online tools like quizzes or Kahoot or Blookit. I personally try to end every class with a couple of quick games that cover the topic that we just learned. And that also hits Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel-winning psychiatrist. He talks about the peak end rule, that people tend to remember how things end, and that influences how they approach future beginnings. So I try to always have the class end with an upbeat game.
Yeah.
Right. And it helps inform not only get students in a positive frame of mind, but it helps inform my instruction going forward, because I see if students have learned the content that I want them to learn.
Sure.
So those are a couple of things for relevance, you know, for autonomy and relatedness, you know, small groups, easy to have students choose small groups to do a variety of different activities. Doesn't mean that they always have to choose their own groups. Giving them various options of how to create a product, whether it's a slideshow or a handmade poster or a video, right, in terms of autonomy. For relatedness, to make sure that students feel confident that they can achieve what you're asking them to do. You know, graphic organizers, engineering the text so that instead of giving students a very document wall-to-wall text, create white space, include images, have bold title headings, have some vocabulary definitions. With online stuff, it's fairly easy to do, and especially with the advent of artificial intelligence, it's even going to be a lot easier to do.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in terms of relatedness, just the basic stuff of being able to pronounce your student's name correctly.
Great point.
All right. And when you do it, and if you do make a mistake, take it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Right. If I can't pronounce a student's name correctly, I make it. It's not his fault. It's my fault.
Yep.
I mean, those are, you know, are a few things. Another thing in terms of competence, this idea of temporal comparisons. In other words, having students creating opportunities for students to compare where they are now with where they were before,
yep. Yep.
as opposed to comparing themselves with yep. how their classmates are doing.
Yeah, you know, and all of these that you mentioned, I'm sure we could go through a whole bunch more. They're multi-purposed. They're not just there, and they're long-term. They're going to produce long-term results. They're also going to create routines. I don't know if you noticed I was laughing or smiling because at one point, kind of embarrassingly, because you were talking about the end of class and the idea of games and having that be something predictable. And that, I think you called it the peak. I don't remember with the researcher that you mentioned, right. The peak. And people tend to remember that. And I was thinking of, I have a few memories, and one of which is the day that I realized that giving homework, just to give homework as a young teacher, I realized this, was not a good practice, because I would end my class, and I'm so embarrassed to say this, but I'll be vulnerable here. I would end my class many days scurrying to say, oh my God, what's the homework going to be for tonight? Right. Instead of taking that moment, and it would usually be something that was worthless, because I was told and I was taught that homework was a part of the curriculum and I needed to give it. And I remember one day doing that, it occurred to me, what am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? I teach high school Spanish. Nobody's really looking at me like they're looking at some of the math and English teachers. So let me just do an experiment and see. You know, homework is really completely necessary. And it turns out, and this is just my own opinion, my own anecdote, that it wasn't, that ending class in the way that you just described, instead of going through the motions and trying, we'll get into this in a second, and trying to dangle a carrot for a grade and that extrinsic motivation does not really work the way that I wanted it to work. So anybody out there that's still doing that, and I'm sure there are many, you know, think about that. Think about what that's doing in the long term.
Yeah. I mean, certainly at times homework can function on occasion as something useful in some situations, but most of the time, at least in my experience, most of the time it's not very effective. And a hell of a lot of the time students aren't going to do it anyway. Right. You know, it's like that infamous quote from General Douglas MacArthur, he never gave an order that he wasn't absolutely sure was going to be followed, right? I mean, right? I mean, why give home? Why assign homework if students aren't going to do it?
And why assign it? Even worse for me, just to assign it because I thought that's what I was supposed to do.
Right.
Let's get into that a little bit. I'm kind of like self-transitioning here into this idea of something that you mentioned earlier, which is carrots and sticks. This is a topic that I'm kind of obsessed with. And you know, you call it dangling carrots, and you categorize them earlier a bit in the book, and in the excerpts that I read, it was grades, points, gold stars, etc. You mentioned some other ones earlier. It's obviously extrinsic motivation. And in my experience, as you just mentioned, it if it works at all, it typically only works for kind of short-term goals, or in certain students. I'll reference like my oldest daughter, who is just, that's what she does. School works for her. Homework is good for her. She understands, she's an academic. But from the majority of students I taught in high school, that was not the case. It's something that's deeply entrenched in the educational systems at all levels. So thinking, I guess, if you could, specifically about multilingual learners, but again, we said we'd talk about all students, are those extrinsic motivation strategies doing more harm than good, in your opinion? And if so, should we be shifting away from them?
Well, first, I should say that I don't necessarily think it's a question of all intrinsic or all extrinsic, that it is, it's more which side do you tend to do more of?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, I certainly have and will continue to use some extrinsic motivation with students, right? Because as you say, short term, but sometimes you need those short term results, right? You know, it's, you know, we don't, and I think we may talk about this a little later, but, you know, I was a community organizer for 19 years prior to becoming a teacher, and we talked about the world as it is compared to the world as we'd like it to be. And the world as it is, certainly in extrinsic motivation, some, you know, has a role. And even with me, right, that, you know, I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I wanted to do it to help me become a better teacher. You know, I'll probably help my ego a little bit too. And I also get royalties, little as they may be. So there's a, you know, it's a mix. So I think, you know, in the world as we'd like it to be, you know, we all do everything just because it's the right thing to do. In the world as it is, there are other reasons, but again, it's a question, which do you do more of?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, if you got something on the board and everybody gets a point, or a check mark based on everything they do during the class, you know, I think that's harmful to students. And I also think it's harmful to teachers.
Teachers.
You know, that it's much, I don't think that's particularly energizing.
Yeah.
If I feel that students aren't going to do anything in my class unless they get a point, or if they're going to get punished for it, right? That, I think we want to create an environment where more often than not, students want to do it because it's interesting and it's fun and it thinks it's going to help them. And then if they don't do it, they're going to get into trouble. I mean, I think that's, again, that's more energizing for the teacher as well.
Yep.
Right. I know that my most de-energizing days are when I feel that I have to go heavy on the extrinsic stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? Whether I have to send someone to the office because of behavior issues, or, you know, students just didn't do something when they were supposed to, and so I've got to offer them some extra credit to do something. That's when I feel most de-energized.
Yeah. And it can become a cycle, right? I mean, if you're feeling de-energized frequently, it's going to be probably harder for you to put in what might be more of an initial investment in intrinsic motivation. And you can then rely on that extrinsic motivation to try to kind of get you through the day. But then those days pile up and it leads to exhaustion. I was just
it'll stop working at some point.
Exactly.
With some students, at least.
Yep.
Maybe
yep.
not with everybody, but with some students it's going to stop working. And then where are you?
Yeah, you've lost them. And I was just reading an article the other day, and I just looked to see if I have it up, and I don't, but I actually, it was in the 74, and it was talking about, sort of accelerated learning. And the other side of that is this learning loss, and, you know, because of COVID and everything with students. And then it talked about this idea, and I please don't quote me on this, but it's something about like teaching loss, the loss of the ability to teach effectively as a result of everything that happened in the pandemic. And the idea was that many teachers are reverting to sort of outdated teaching strategies because of the exhaustion and because of the trauma. And that's creating this cycle. And a lot of those, I'm just making this connection now on the fly, as you can probably tell, but a lot of those are largely tied to the use of extrinsic motivators rather than intrinsic motivators, perhaps the overuse of them. So that's an interesting connection. I asked you when you were speaking, how so with teachers? And then I'm sort of making that connection there.
Well, yeah, and that report, I think certainly that's probably the case for some teachers. In general, that particular report was based on interviews with district leaders who I feel were sort of throwing teachers under the bus,
yep,
and escaping, you know, without taking responsibility for their lack of leadership and forethought in terms of maybe providing professional development and support for teachers to be energized and to learn new skills. I mean, this issue of professional development, which I think is very, very important and very good. A lot of districts don't do it, you know, haven't provided good professional development, haven't provided subs, you know, or require, you know, or if they do provide professional development, expects teachers to do it after schools, mm-hmm. after the school day when we're exhausted. But yeah, I mean, I think teachers are tired. I think, I mean, I would agree. I certainly would attest to that. I was just telling my wife this past week that how this coming year goes for me will determine how much longer I teach. Mm-hmm. That if next year is the way last year was, I will teach fewer years afterwards than if next year is closer to what it was pre-pandemic.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm hearing that quite a bit. And, you know, just to tie this up, as I kind of went, and clearly you've read that report, I figured you had, you know, this idea of quality PD and giving teachers what they need to be intrinsically motivated to do the job and to not sort of, I'm not going to say what first comes to my mind is go through the motions, but there are no, I mean, there are no too many teachers that can just go through the motions and last very long in this profession. And perhaps that's leading to what you're talking about now, which is this exhaustion. And so just as the teacher that we're talking about today needs to be able to provide the elements of autonomy and relatedness and competence and relevance to our students, so do the administrators and school leaders to teachers. I mean, we talk about this all the time. It's the very same thing. And when it breaks down at any level, it's going to affect all of the other parts of the machine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it works. It works for all of us, right? It works for our students. It works for our children. It works for teachers. It works for principals, right? I mean, it's and unfortunately, I think in terms of district leadership, especially for some leaders who have not been teachers, that they have not been very effective at applying it. For example, our district has for the past 6 years has had a superintendent who's been awful and who fortunately resigned July 1st. But the success that we have had with our students has been done over the past several years has happened in spite of him, mm-hmm. not because of him. So, I mean, one of the many problems with virtual learning is that oftentimes, I mean, I think when we're in the classroom, it's easier for good administrators and teachers to minimize the damage that unskilled district leaders can do. Mm-hmm. But when we were in distance learning, a lot of the decisions that they made affected, you know, how it was structured. And there was just so much that we could do that we were not, but I think the pandemic made things a lot more difficult for unskilled district leaders to hide their lack of skills.
Fly under the radar.
Yeah.
All right. So We've covered most of what I was interested in chatting with you about. I just want to, like, you had mentioned this idea that this you had kind of referenced this quote that I had put in as a question that I wanted to ask you. And I think it's such a great quote. And I'm just going to read it really quick, and then I'll say why I think it's important. And again, you referenced this. You said it is also important to keep in mind that students and the rest of us can be motivated by both a desire to learn what is being taught and wanting a good grade, just as interest in being a better teacher motivated me, you, to write this book, as well as the possible additional income I could gain from royalties. First of all, I just think it's such a great, honest statement. And I appreciate you, I commend you for writing it. It seems simple, but it doesn't happen often enough. And on the topic of what we're talking about today, it is such a great example of why both of these, when I asked you the question about extrinsic motivation and should we be leaning more toward the other way, I was hoping to garner the kind of response that I got from you, which is like, we don't abandon one to have the other. And what you said was you got to figure out where your balance is and where you are. And I just think that quote really kind of speaks to that. It also, in a third kind of level, talks about how this is a human issue, not a student issue, right? This is something that that we all kind of benefit from if we do it the right way and we find the right balance. So I just wanted to point that out before we wrap up here.
Yeah, I mean, it's so often in our culture, people want to view it as all of this thing or all of this thing or black and white. That
especially
it's
in
this,
education, this thing's gone. Yeah. I'm going to try this thing. Reframe.
Right.
Or sorry to interrupt you, but I can't resist. Or I don't like what's happening this year, but I know it's going to change next year. So I'll just ignore it as a teacher and do my own thing. And eventually it'll go away, right?
For better. Right. 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 I mean, I think it's just, you know, where do we tend to do more of, right? I mean, we need to be comfortable with ambiguity, comfortable with sometimes things will work. You know, I mean, for this class, maybe a particular class maybe needs a little more extrinsic motivators than this particular class or this particular student. And that's okay, right? I mean, we just can't be dogmatic or ideological. We've got to base what we do on what our experience is. I mean, Dylan William, the education researcher, talks a lot about education research. I'm saying that it's you really can't apply a lot of research. You can't apply research everywhere, right? I mean, there's this in the classroom. It really depends. I mean, a real good example of this was one question I had this year was, should I have students in my U.S. history class watch a video first about something and then read about it, or should they read about it and then watch a video? And I asked students, and students told me, practically everyone said, oh, we like reading it and then watching the video, right? And I put that question out to the broader education community, the ELL community, and really there wasn't any research about it. Right. I mean, there isn't. It depends.
Yeah.
It depends on students' fluency. It depends on the accessibility of the video. It depends on the accessibility of the writing. Right. It depends on the language level. And that's the case for so many of the instructional strategies that we do. It just depends.
It comes back to the idea of, you said, be comfortable with ambiguity. And you know, you talk about the de-energizing moments in teaching. For me, the most energizing moments and the ones that I miss more than anything is when you're in the middle of a class and something comes up that you had no clue would come up, but it's such an incredible moment, and we just say, we're going to go with this and we're going to see where it goes. And yeah, it can fail and flop, but if it fails and flops, that's a lesson for everybody. And you
oh, yeah.
And if it works, it can be magic.
Yeah, if it fails, the students will forget about it the next day anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, we'll self-analyze
Separate.
It in our heads for a long time, but the students will be, oh, whatever. I mean, it's
Great. Well, Larry, this has been such a great conversation. I feel like there's so many more things I could ask you, but I want to keep this to be a reasonable time for people who are listening and whose commute is about to end or saying, wow, how long is this going to go for? Because this will be a one part episode. We'll have to try to do it again, maybe next year. I know you try to do things only during the summertime, which I appreciate about you as well. And so we'll try to reconnect then. There are a couple things that I took note of that I think would be fun to talk about. But in the meantime, how can people learn more about the work you're doing? You're kind of everywhere. You're super prolific. When I mentioned I was chatting with you today to a few of my colleagues, they said to say thank you for the work that you're doing, first of all. And then they said, I don't understand how he does everything that he does. Nor do I, but you do. So where can people go to learn about what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think just type my name in the search and that'll lead you either to my website, so the day blog, or my Education Week column, which is basically sort of a teacher advice column. And on the blog, you can see links to the different books. And also, there are a fair number of animated videos that I've done with Education Week, and we're going to have a couple of more come out on using artificial intelligence with students soon. So that'll be good.
We did one toward the end of last season, a podcast episode with a gentleman by the name of Chris Mize at Stanford doing some work on AI. And boy, it was a fun conversation. So I'm looking forward to that animated series.
Yeah. Well, I think AI, I disagree with Sal Khan and Bill Gates. It's going to revolutionize education, but I think it can have a huge impact on second language learning, on English language learning. I think it'll have more of an impact there than in education in general. But I know that I'm a minority in terms of the technologists out there. But that's just my
that makes it more fun to talk to you than everybody else in the echo chamber. I'll earmark that one too as another possible topic. Okay, so one more question for you, Larry. I asked you this last time, and I ask everybody who comes on. As I said, you continue to do a lot of sort of prolific producing of all kinds of material. You just mentioned some of it, and we'll link to all that. What are you consuming right now? Is there a book or film or other resource that's having an influence on you right now that you'd share? And I'll just repeat the fact that this does not have to be, it can be, but it does not have to be academic. It can really be anything at all.
Well, during the summer, I tend to, any reading I do tends to be more of the escapist variety. So I'm reading, Preston and Child have this series about an FBI agent named Pendergast. So I'm reading the latest, and I mean, they probably have 10 or 12 books in the series. So I'm reading the latest in that. So it's just, it has zero academic applicability to teaching. It's just bubblegum for the brain.
Yeah. So it has an applicability in that it allows you to relax a little bit and decompress. And that's important.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what I have. That's what I've been doing lately. So in terms of reading, so I've had to do a lot of, Katie Hall and I are working on a second edition of the ELL Teacher's Toolbox, and we've been brushing up on a lot of studies and reflecting on our own work to revise that extensively.
So, well, I look forward to that one as well. That's one that's on my shelf and that I think is on a lot of people's shelves. That'll be exciting.
Yeah, it'll be good. We've just finished revising the 44 existing chapters, and now that we're going to add 16 new ones, but we're not until next summer. So this summer was the revising the old ones. Next summer is the 16 new ones, and it'll be out in the early spring of 2025.
Great. So, we'll look forward to all those things. We will link to as much of your stuff as possible, or at least a gateway for anybody to kind of choose what they want to consume, because it's a choose your own adventure kind of thing with everything that you have out there. And I'm going to end this the same way that I think I ended the last one, which is to say, I don't know how you do everything that you do, but I'm glad you do. And I know I speak for a lot of people who are listening. So thanks for joining us, Larry, taking the time, and I hope we can keep in touch.
Well, and thank you for doing this podcast and for your work. It's this podcast is certainly on my best list of ELL podcasts for teachers to listen to.
Thanks. Means a lot.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.